Some 50 years ago, in the midst of the Second World War, a famine spread across eastern India and claimed 3 million lives. It was called the Bengal Famine of 1943, the result of wartime economic blockades as much as anything else. The disaster helped define India's outlook for decades. The country grew wary of foreign political and economic interests, and it succeeded in growing enough food to feed its own people. Now, as the global economy has expanded, there's been a change in Indian philosophy. Officials no longer praise the virtues of economic protectionism. Instead, it's foreign investment and exports they want. All this has some in India worried. With a population that will soon top 1 billion, there's a concern that the country's economic shift outward will undermine India's self-sufficiency in food production. Sandy Tolan has this report.
The death of 3 million people had a way of burning into memory. At the brink of independence, leaders of a free India remembered the Bengal famine and said, never again.
When India became independent, the first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, he said everything else can wait but not agriculture, because people can do without anything but they can't without food.
From that point, says M.S. Swaminathan, the leading figure in modern Indian agriculture, self-reliance became a central goal of free India. But for years, the nation struggled, relying on grain imports from abroad. In 1966, a severe drought created food shortages, and India turned to the United States to avert another famine.
And so that is why that we stand here this afternoon in Omaha, at the end of a very important lifeline.
Standing in the Nebraska plains, President Lyndon Johnson dispatched 9 million tons of grain from America to India. It was enough to fill a line of boxcars from New York to Denver. The massive peacetime armada was launched with a mixture of Great Society rhetoric and Cold War rationale.
No peace and no power is strong enough to stand for long against the restless discontent of millions of human beings who are without any hope. At the other end of that lifeline, 8,000 long miles out yonder, is India. India, a nation of 500 million human beings. The wheat here.
It was then that India began a massive effort to modernize its agriculture, using American chemicals, fertilizers, and hybrid seeds. But non-aligned India was never lured into the U.S. economic camp, and few foreign companies were allowed access to the vast Indian market. Now, 2 decades after India achieved food self-sufficiency, the new global economy has come calling in India, and things are changing. India is inviting multinational companies to come in and invest in Indian agriculture, and many are laying ambitious new plans for the export of food. A sheet of rice cascades down a chute in a processing mill outside of New Delhi.
Basmati rice is called king of rice.
Ramesh Bansal, manager of rice operations for Pepsi Foods of India, reaches into the ivory stream, getting a handful of export-quality basmati rice.
All over the world, they pray for this rice. They love it. This is the best rice available in the world.
Outside the mill, barefoot workers in turbans and dark mustaches heap big bags of rice onto a flatbed truck. This is India integrating into the world economy. Foreign companies investing in new facilities, providing jobs to a massive unskilled labor force, and to train professionals like Ramesh Bansal.
In a year, we buy about 500,000 bags.
Last year, Pepsi processed 10,000 tons of basmati for export. This year, the company is aiming for twice that much, and another doubling by 1996. And nearly all of it is headed out of India, where people are willing to pay more for premium rice.
This is going to the States, United States, European countries, Middle East, all over.
Well, exports are absolutely critical.
In his high-ceilinged office near India Gate, Delhi's Great Stone Arch, India's finance secretary outlines the vision behind the country's sharp change of direction. Mantek Singh Ahluwalia, former World Bank economist, says India can no longer afford to be insular.
there's a clear recognition that in the kind of world we live in and the kind of world that's emerging, I mean, the only way that India will do well and fully utilize what is a tremendous potential of entrepreneurial spirit and human resources in this country is if it becomes a more open, more competitive, more integrated economy. And that's what we're doing.
But across rural India, millions of small farmers are worried about the new global economy and the coming of the multinationals and what they fear will be a transformation of the land. In the tropical heat near the South Indian city of Bangalore, in the shade of an old peepal tree, a farmer in white homespun cotton, a green sash, and Coke bottle glasses belts out a song of protest. We are half starved, half naked, the song goes. We are warning you, bureaucrats, be careful. We are ready to fight.
They will be totally displaced within a short span of time.
M.D. Nanjundaswamy, farmer, state legislator, and law professor, is the leader of a massive farm protest movement.
It's happening in developed countries, even with farmers. They're getting displaced, uprooted. And it will happen at a much faster speed in India because the farmers are all small farmers. And that population comes to around 500 million.
Over the last year, Nanjundaswamy has organized protest rallies reaching 500,000 people. At issue is the Indian government's support of a global trade alliance called the GATT, which allows multinationals broad access to Indian markets. The farmers are especially worried that as multinational seeds and fertilizers come to dominate the market, traditional Indian agriculture will be transformed into high-cost, high-profit businesses. This, they claim, will push millions of small farmers off their lands. The government and foreign companies in India say these are wild exaggerations designed by opponents to whip up irrational fears. But other critics say by endorsing economic liberalization, the government is undermining the food self-sufficiency India struggled so hard to achieve. Already the demand for basmati rice is starting to affect what farmers in the grain belt north of Delhi are planting. In some cases, wheat, a staple in India's food security program, is being taken out of production. One initial estimate suggests 10% of the land in India's northern wheat belt will be converted to exports. Some economists predict it will be more. Arun Kumar of Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi says now that the global economy is interconnected, consumers in distant lands will dictate what Indian farmers grow.
The demand patterns in the advanced nations will profoundly affect what India produces, what Indian agriculture produces. And therefore, what the Indian poor or the average Indian requires is unlikely to be produced, and what will be produced is what can sell in the other countries, the richer countries, which have 85% of the world's purchasing power. And therefore, the Indian poor will suffer a great deal.
I don't think there's any such danger.
The Indian Finance Secretary, Mantek Singh Ahluwalia.
The proportion of agricultural exports, including potential agricultural exports, to the total production is really quite small. As you move towards a stronger agriculture, which is opened up to export possibilities, the scope for yield improvement will swamp any possible increase in exports that might take place. So I don't think food security is a danger at all.
That is still an open question in India. Higher production per acre could compensate for an increase in export lands, as the finance secretary suggests. On the other hand, India's growing population will soon be twice the 500 million President Johnson spoke of back in 1966. And as India's population grows, so does its ability to consume the goods of multinationals. More than wealthy consumers in America or Europe, it's the 200 million Indian middle-class consumers that lure foreign companies to India. 100 miles north of Pepsi's Basmati rice mill, white-smocked workers squirt orange soda concentrate into an assembly line of glass bottles.
In 1991, we sold about 15 million cases.
This is Pepsi's soft drink factory in the northern state of Punjab.
In 1992, we have sold 20 million cases, and the figure in 1993 was 24 and a half.
Pradeep Saldana joined Pepsi a few years ago from Union Carbide. He knows that Americans drink 250 times more cola than Indians, and he sees a tremendous untapped market.
And that's the task number one which Pepsi has on hand, that is to increase the consumption of all its products.
Saldana also oversees the snack food factory next door, built in a former wheat field, which now makes Cheetos and Ruffles. Some of that goes to the Middle East, but Saldana is more interested in Indian consumers.
The fact is that there is an ever-increasing middle class in India, which is asking for more of these convenience foods, which is asking for more hygienically packed foods, which are also asking for more standardized and uniform products. It only depends on what the customer is seeking, and we seek to provide only what the customer wants. Obviously, what the expectation of not only us, but most multinationals is, that the Indian middle class, which is almost 200 million strong, is only going to grow. And so is the requirement for these products.
The appearance of potato chips and soda pop and processed foods like tomato paste won't necessarily undermine Indian food security, but economic growth and consumer demand will generate new tastes. Some experts warn these Western-style tastes will lead many Indians, traditionally vegetarians, to eat more meat and dairy products, which require more land and more grain to produce. S.K. Sinha, director of India's Agricultural Research Institute, believes this could overtax India's land base, already under stress, just to produce enough grain to feed people.
With the change in the economic policy, the economic growth, once it takes place, it is already happening, that the preference for some of the animal products would increase. That, to me, is a major concern. If we were to change over to the animal food chain, then we will have a very, very serious problem. There is no doubt.
Some economists say there needn't be a concern. What matters, they say, is generating economic growth so people have money. Money will generate demand, which will create incentives for more production of food, whether it's curried lamb, processed tomato paste, or a couple of pounds of wheat. And if there's not enough wheat in the country anymore, they say, India can buy some with its export earnings. That kind of talk makes many Indians nervous, and the government, in part out of political necessity, insists it will never abandon its policy of producing enough grain to feed its people. But as economic liberalization brings irrevocable change, supporters say trust is necessary. Trust that India's new path will be good for rich and poor alike, that embracing the multinationals will not lead to another era of foreign domination. But the arrival of multinationals taps a deep fear among many Indians who feel their colonial roots.
Entering of all foreigners, we don't know who are they, good or bad.
Back in the south of India, Sesha Reddy, a farmer and activist, points through the window of the beat-up taxi. A Hindu temple rolls past, a rock wall covered in ivy, deep green rice paddies, and people on foot, on the handlebars of bicycles, perched on rickety bullock carts. As Reddy travels the rural south, he tries to organize opposition to the multinationals by reminding villagers of the nation's colonial legacy.
We had been subjected to foreign rule for many centuries. We are ruled about for 300 years by British people.
This time, Sesha Reddy says the colonial power is not the British, but multinational companies like Cargill and W.R. Grace.
We don't want this Cargill once again to dominate our economy, our freedom, our politics. We are prepared to die.
A year and a half ago, Reddy and 500 other farmers ransacked the South India offices of Cargill, one of the world's biggest grain traders, calling on the company to quit India. But Cargill's seed sales are up 300% over last year, and the company's manager for India, John Hamilton, says the protests are just publicity stunts by local politicians.
We will always have some ratbags in the world. the world is always going to have some extremist who wants to find some problem with the activities of some company. As far as Cargill is concerned, we will not let one small-time politician campaigning against our seed company run us out of the business.
Cargill and other foreign companies who've come to India say all they want to do is sell productive seeds that will give farmers higher yields. And that would mean more income, which is the ultimate protection against hunger. And even M.S. Swaminathan, who helped design the policies that made India self-sufficient, says perhaps the protesters ought to have less fear of foreigners and more confidence in themselves.
I think there is too much of fear of multinationals, you know, from the first world, that they are here coming. Once again, the East India Company is coming in a new garb, in the form of Cargill, Mr. Hamilton, or whoever it is, to suppress our farmers and to conquer our country. I think there's something in the psyche of a colonial past which makes you suspect too much and suffer from an inferiority complex. I always tell them, why are you underestimating our own capacity to compete with Cargill or somebody else?
But in the more remote places, outside the cities, where three-fourths of the people live, it may be quite a while before the global economy brings prosperity. A rural market at dusk along a ravaged dirt road in Bihar, India's poorest state. Barrel cactuses poke through dried soil. Distant hills, jagged like cut glass, turn purple as evening comes. The merchants have spread their blankets out on the earth. It seems everyone has something to sell, but there aren't many takers. A man peddles saris for 65 cents. He hasn't sold one all day. Onions are 8 cents a pound. No one has bought a single one. A few beans change hands, bought with cupfuls of rice as currency. It's hard to imagine a market like this turning modern, with new systems of roads and infrastructure to carry rural Indian produce out to the world, or being infused suddenly with cash to buy the packaged goods of multinationals. But change is coming. Amartya Sen, an Indian economist who is considered one of the world's foremost experts on hunger and famine, says opening the economy to the world can be a good thing, as long as India is careful.
To see it as a peril is probably a mistake. On the other hand, the smugness in thinking that it could not generate a problem is a mistake too. Now, the real trouble, I think the real tragedy in India, I think, now is this, that you get one group of people who would say economic growth is very important, and therefore all these other things, it doesn't matter. We have the first thing first. And then you get another group, you'd say economic growth is completely unimportant. What we really need is social opportunity. But none of these are right, of course. You know, there's a Bengali saying that she who cooks, does she not also want to comb her hair? It's not so much that the liberalization has been a mistake, but to focus so much on liberalization is a mistake. There are so many other things to be done.
47 years after independence and half a century after the Bengal famine, India is making a calculated gamble in joining the world economy, that its food security will be enhanced by abandoning its historic mistrust of outsiders, that the new farm products of the multinationals will bring more profits, not displacement, that higher income will create more buying power, not more disparity and hunger, that India will benefit by joining its fate with the powerful forces of the new global capitalism. This is Sandy Tolan reporting.